Good morning and Happy New Year. Welcome to our homemade program devoted to reviewing some of last year's noteworthy deaths. Paraphrasing Pete Hamill, we know that the cause of death is always life. Our reviews of the five lives featured on this program devote almost no attention to the technical reasons for our subjects' deaths. What matters is each life and how it was lived. This is the second consecutive year of beginning with this theme. Will it become a tradition? We Kansans learn early on that one crocus does not make a spring. We've seen too much ice and snow in April and even early May to be wary of making generalizations from small samples. That said, it won't surprise me if this service does become a tradition. The program committee begins each year knowing that Michael Nelson and other UU ministers will cover about half the Sundays, leaving the committee the challenge of filling the other 26. Once we find a format that pleases at least some members, irritates relatively few of them, and lends itself to easy replication, he said ever so modestly, there is a very high probability that we will see future versions of that model. Only time will tell. I direct your attention to the order of service for announcements of coming events. Lots of them. They are to be read carefully and committed to memory, marked on your calendar, whether it be the electronic or paper version, so that you will get there and do whatever else is requested of you to get yourself there. There's more information about fellowship activities in the January newsletter, copies of which are available in the narthex as well as online at uufm.net. And I have some additional announcements to read. From the Fair Trade Project, inventory seems to be shrinking during the week. If you take an item from the closet, be sure to leave money or an IOU. And if you owe money, please pay up. This is signed by Sheriff Ann Cohen. Cowan. You will see on scattered around through the room blank pieces of white paper, and Elka Lorenz wants me to remind you, as the program does, the notes in the program, that we, I'll just read it. As we enter a new year, many of us recommit ourselves to spiritual, social, and perhaps even material goods and aspirations in the ongoing pursuit of personal growth and fulfillment. Individual hopes and visions of the new year, as well as reflections on the old, contributed by members of the fellowship, will be woven together to reflect both common and personal challenges and dreams within our community. Now, if you have anything like a dream or a challenge or whatever that you'd like to be sure gets included in that program, if you will write it down, you may sign it if you wish. You may be anonymous if you wish, but Elka would like to have your help. I think that's it. As Dan comes forward to light the chalice this morning, we'll do it with the assistance of Robert Weston as we pay respects to those who died last year. May we find a kinship with all life, reaching across all barriers of race, philosophies, and creeds, making us one with everything that lives, and as with our inmost atom, each bright star. Now, the opening hymn is printed with that booklet that you received on your way in here. I will sing it, the first verse once, and then if you will stand, we will sing all three verses together. Okay? Mm-hmm. wagon bound for market. There's a calf with a mournful eye. High above him there's a swallow, winging swiftly through the sky. How the winds are laughing, they laugh with all their might. Laugh and laugh the whole day through and half the summer's night. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. All right, stand up, please. On a wagon bound for market, there's a calf with a mournful eye. High above him there's a swallow, winging swiftly through the sky. How the winds are laughing, they laugh with all their might. Laugh and laugh the whole day through and half the summer's night. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. Oh, stop complaining, said the farmer. Who told you a calf to be? Why can't you have wings to fly with, like the swallow so proud and free? How the winds are laughing, they laugh with all their might. Laugh and laugh the whole day through and half the summer's night. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. Stock calves are easily bound and slaughtered, never knowing the reason why. But whoever treasures freedom, like the swallow, has learned to fly. How the winds are laughing, they laugh with all their might. Laugh and laugh the whole day through and half the summer's night. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona. Dona, 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 dona.
Thank you.
Well, I didn't have any idea how many children were here. There was some effort to scare them off. I think maybe we are not to be afraid of. Anyway, well, why don't the children who are here come on up? We'll come on up. We'll do what we can.
Just have a seat there.
I'll start with this. Are you it? All right. Okay. Now, what I thought I would do is involve the congregation in there. All right, there's another kid in this, and we would do something just a little bit different. And here's what I propose to do: talk a little bit about New Year's resolutions. First, let me read an introduction to this. Last week, a wise person in the BC comic strip dispensed this advice: the secret to successful New Year's resolutions is to select sensible, obtainable goals. In the final frame, a not very skinny character has written this on the wall: this year, I will gain only 5 pounds. Now, with this guideline, what I would like for people to do, we'll start out here in the audience. And I would like for you to Tell me a New Year's resolution. Tell us all a New Year's resolution. Again, one that is reasonable, one that might possibly be attained, if you can come up with such a thing. And then we'll share this with the children, and perhaps they can come up with some resolutions of their own. We will see how this works. All right, who's going to run the mic around? Don't hold back. We'll start out. Well, you have one. You have a New Year's resolution?
No.
All right. Well, maybe you will.
Dick Beeman. Michael, I'm going to combine my New Year's resolution with a joy, because it's so profound that I have to state it. After about 40 years as an entomologist, I retired yesterday, and my New Year's resolution is for this year to paint as many pretty pictures as I can.
Well, my New Year's resolution is to actually meditate every day like I'm supposed to. So, yeah.
I'm going to learn to play one more song on my banjo that I've had since 1969.
Personal request to you all. Why don't you write down those resolutions and hand them in to me? Thank you. My resolution is to speak up whenever it's necessary. I've done it a couple of times this year, and I shall continue to do so.
Well, mine's kind of, again, a joy, concern, and a resolution. Since my mother passed on Friday night, I'm going to have to learn in the next year to live without her there at Metalark. And it's starting, and we will continue tomorrow at 3 o'clock as we have the service for her to begin the rest of the lives without my mother.
I'm going to say no to joining new committees.
Maybe this is only one Mark will appreciate. I'll try to get at least my 6,000 miles in this year.
I'll tell you.
And what he's talking about is my resolution to start writing again.
My resolution last year was to be nicer to Theus, and to be supportive and appreciative of their beliefs. And I didn't do very well. And so I'm going to change it this year. I'm going to continue that. But I'm going to put it in the context of expecting the same back from them.
Bryce Hobrock, my resolution is to finish writing my memoir this year, but as I live on and on, those memoirs just continue to grow.
I'm Ellie Sayer, and my resolution this year is to do all the writing that I mean to do. Arthur's resolution this year is to eat the microphone and maybe grow some teeth.
Stephen Mall, I'm going to quit saying I'm going to go back to the gym.
Shirley Hobrock, I'm going to slow down this year. Take things slower.
Morning, Kathleen Oldfather, and I'm going to follow up from Jim's. Well, he's going to learn to say goodbye to his mother this year. I'm learning to say hello to my parents who have moved to Meadowlark over Christmas and are in healthcare, the skilled healthcare area, and doing well, adjusting. but it's brought a lot of joy and change into our life. So, and the other thing, really kind of dumb, but last year I swore I was going to start reading that Wall Street Journal that comes to our house every day, and I didn't do it once. So I'm going to try that again.
I'll share. Well, how about it? Children, anything you might promise to do this year that would make you a better citizen or maybe make your parents happier? Anything like that? Oh, okay. All right.
Make their breakfast.
Oh,
need to hold the microphone.
Well, maybe next year. All right. Well, are we off to some other destination here? No? Oh, I'm sorry.
Marilyn Kalbalam, this is a corollary to Stephen's resolution. I'm going to start doing exercises so I don't have all the aches and pains I have every morning.
So is your daughter staying or is she going off to what? Okay. All right. Go now in peace. Go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you. Everywhere you may go. Where have all the children gone? Yeah, okay, all right. I started reading obituaries when I was about 9 years old. It's been a great learning experience for me. One thing, it's been a good vocabulary builder. I learned words like florist and predeceased and widower. Regarding the last of these words, I already knew what a widow was, but I was struck by the fact that so very few obituaries listed a man as the surviving spouse. When I asked my mother and father why wives always seemed to outlive their husbands, I got two very different answers, which I leave to your imagination. My fascination with obituaries also contributed to the development of some very useful mathematical skills. In the Beatrice, Nebraska Daily Sun, the notices were headed by the deceased's name and years of his or her birth and death. So it would be something like this: John G. Jurgens, 1871 to 1949. I forced myself to do the math in my head to figure out how old Mr. Jurgens was when he died without reading the story. 29 years in the 19th century plus 49 in the 20th equals 78, just in case you're still wondering how old he was. I think I was in the eighth grade when my unnatural preoccupation with the final chapter in people's lives intersected with my first exposure to Shakespeare, the tragedy of Julius Caesar. The play's stilted language didn't appeal much to my male peers and me, but we sure enjoyed the murders and battles. I was especially impressed by Mark Antony's funeral oration for the title character. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him, which, as you may recall, turned out to be a lie. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. That was not the case in the obituaries I read when I was a kid, and it is certainly not what one routinely finds in fairly lengthy Manhattan Mercury obituaries. A couple of years later, still deep in my bout with adolescence, A man our family knew well died. Riding across town with my dad, I said something like, "Well, good riddance to that jerk." Dad's response was immediate and sharp. "We don't speak ill of the dead." "Only when they're alive?" I asked. Remembering very, shall we say, uncomplimentary comments my dad had recently made about this very man. Unable to leave well enough alone, I asked this question. "Did Hitler get nicer after he died?" That ended all conversation until well after we reached our destination. Late in my 20s, Charles Stephen, minister emeritus of the Lincoln Unitarian Church, who's spoken here many times, introduced me to the New York Times obituaries. For many years afterwards, I read Times obits only on those infrequent occasions when I saw copies of the paper. Now, thanks to Al Gore's invention of the internet, a couple of keystrokes take me to the Times obituary column nearly every morning. Today's obituary was about Evan L. Bennett, Jr., and if you don't know about him, you should. He was an incredible guy. Deciphered ancient texts that had been a mystery to many other people. Anyway, last year, many of the books I've read in the last 15 years or so were written by or about someone I discovered in a Times obituary. Last year, about 56 million people died worldwide. Perhaps 2.5 million of them were Americans. More than 1,000 of those deaths were reported in the Times. In a few minutes, my co-conspirators this morning will provide their personal reflections on 5 of the noteworthy deaths that made the cut to appear in the Times. Perhaps they will seduce you to take up the habit of reading the Times obits and the compulsion to learn more about the lives and contributions of the new friends you find there. As addictions go, this one isn't too bad. The offertory this morning comes from Fauré's Requiem, which is regarded as the one that, of all of them, that within the constraints of the Catholic Requiem Mass is more about the person who died than about theology. And we'll listen to Pia Jesu, sung by Kathleen Battle. Pia Jesu, Domine, Dona Eis, Requiem, Sempiternam, Requiem, Blessed Jesus, Lord, give them peace, eternal peace. Pete Hamill, who has written a fair number of obituaries in his time, has this to say about the art of doing so. Obituaries are about people one at a time, but they are also part of a collective narrative. So are all of us who lived during even a small part of their time on the stage. The obits remind us of the role of accident, chance, or luck in the living of any life, along with determination and will. Most of us have learned lessons about life and its brother, death, from people who seldom make their way into the obituaries of any major newspaper. One lesson is the acceptance of the inevitable. As writer and entertainer Malachi McCourt likes to say, "I come from a long line of dead people." So do we all. Now, Matt Sayer, not Ayer, will talk about Peter Gomez.
Despite being a Christian, Peter Gomez made me a better Unitarian Universalist. Leaving college, I had something of a chip on my shoulder when it came to religion. So much evil had been done and continued to be done in its name that I came to see it as part of the problem rather than the solution. I cast about and read voraciously, and I attacked religious writing with a fervor, pointing out inconsistencies and injustices before consigning them to the dust heap while feeling extremely clever. One of the first writers to pull me up short was Peter Gomez. The minister at Harvard's Memorial Chapel since the 1970s, as well as a teacher of ethics, Peter Gomez often flew in the face of people's expectations and would ask people, very politely, some very hard questions. Is Christianity a matter of personal piety or the transformative power of compassion for one's fellow man? I was surprised to see a theologian say that the Bible was not the gospel. While it pointed the way to it and preached the good news, it was a library, not a textbook, a catalog of countless people struggling with an incredibly difficult concept and troubles, all trying to find what God wanted of them. It's difficult to take so-called biblical literalists seriously when they take a message of universal compassion and use scripture to oppress or deride people who are disenfranchised and isolated due to their differences. Through the centuries, scripture has been used to justify slavery, gender inequality, anti-Semitism, and even today a rampant homophobia. Peter Gomes came out as gay in 1991, though he remained celibate his entire life, and for 20 years spoke eloquently on the need for religion to embrace homosexuals rather than condemn them. Nothing Jesus ever said would justify hate crimes and harassment, and just because some use the Bible to justify the maintenance of an unjust status quo, it did not follow that Scripture is to blame. The power of the gospel, Gomes argued, was the power of compassion. True compassion can overcome the fear that leads us to gate ourselves off from those who we feel threaten us, physically, economically, or culturally, and stop us from slipping into the mindset that we alone know the mind of God. I had a nagging sense of guilt, even though I was not and never would be a Christian. Unlike many of those I'd read, what he had to say was stated without hate or fear, and in that mirror, I was ashamed. I realized I was doing to the religious precisely what I had accused them of doing to me, selectively reading for what I agreed with or what I didn't, lumping whole categories of people into a box marked other, treating them with suspicion and contempt. After 9/11, he received a great deal of negative attention when he suggested that patriotism might not be enough to justify anything and everything. It was not a time to question, he was told by many, and he was horrified when political leaders cultivated fear as a political resource, driving wedges into the population for their own aggrandizement. It flew in the face of his understanding of Christianity, which was to bring people together and not drive them apart. I remain grateful to him for showing me that Christianity was not the bad guy and that religion did not have to be poisonous. While I remain decidedly secular, he helped me realize for myself that it is quite possible to practice secularism badly without regard for others. And that realization alone makes me a better Unitarian Universalist.
Morning. Tom Phillips. Michael asked me to do this. I'd never done it before and gave me the option to look through the New York Times, and I looked through all the lists of people and came up with a couple and ultimately decided to speak on the life and from the New York Times obit of Betty Ford. Now, I'm a lifelong Democrat, so I really never predicted I'd be standing in front of a congregation such as this, especially in talking about a Republican. But this woman was very amazing, and I want to touch on some of the highlights. And it's just hot off the C drive here. And I am going to read from the New York Times and then a bit from some other popular press, although I did go to the library and get these big things called books, but, you know, it was a lot of fun. So Betty Ford, a social and political activist and the presidential first lady during the term of Gerald Ford, died on July 8, 2011 in Rancho Mirage, California at the age of 93. Today I want to go over again some of her biographical facts. I want to touch a bit then on some key activisms that she was involved with that had to do with social policy and politics, and also those that derive from her own personal struggles. Elizabeth Ann Bloomer was born on April 8, 1918 in Chicago to William S. Bloomer and the former Hortense Near. She was the youngest child and only girl in a family of three children. Her father was a traveling salesman of conveyor belts for factories. The family moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan when she was two, and that's where she grew up and spent most of her early years. The Bloomers were financially comfortable. They lived in a fashionable area and spent summers at Whitefish Lake. Betty began dancing lessons when she was eight, and for two summers after graduation from high school, she attended Bennington School of Dance in Bennington College in Vermont. At 14, she was confirmed an Episcopalian, which was her mother's religion. Her father was a Christian Scientist. That's an interesting combination. And began working on Saturdays as a model for a local department store, the Herpelsheimer's department store. At age 20, she went to New York City, living on the fringes of Greenwich Village, and attended dance classes with the famous Martha Graham. She also joined the Martha Graham troupe. Dance was always her major interest. Mrs. Ford said many times that she was disappointed she had never been quite good enough to be a first-rate dancer. Her mother persuaded her, though, to return to Grand Rapids in 1941, but not before she had modeled on 7th Avenue and for the John Robert Powers Modeling Agency. Back home in Michigan, she became a fashion coordinator for that store in which she had been a teenage model. In her spare time, she taught dance to underprivileged and disabled children. The following year, she married William C. Warren, a furniture dealer who I found out had many other sort of traveling salesman types jobs. They were married 5 years and divorced in 1947. I want to diverge just a bit then to the story of her husband, Gerald Ford, who she married after that. And they were married on October 14th, 1948, while Gerald Ford was running for his first race at a seat in the House, House of Representatives in Washington, of course. The ceremony took place on a Friday so that Mr. Ford's plans to go to the Northwest Michigan football game that day would not be disrupted the next day. And he had played center for Michigan in his college days. He was 35. Betty was 30 at the time. They spent their two-day honeymoon at Republican Party rallies before running off to Washington. Mr. Ford did win the election to the House. And Betty said, "We came to Washington for 2 years and stayed for 28. Now, if there's any of you out there under 40 or perhaps who didn't read about this in school, it's, the Gerald Ford story, just as an aside, is somewhat interesting. He's the only person to ever serve as president without going through a general election or the Electoral College. He was the 38th president of the United States. He was selected and confirmed as vice president under Richard Nixon when a guy named Spiro Agnew resigned his term as vice president and then was involved in some legal problems with tax evasion and money laundering. At the same time, remember early 70s, 71, 72, 73, we had something called the Watergate scandal happening in the Nixon administration. The Vietnam War was sort of wrapping up. So about 10 months into his term as vice president, Richard Nixon resigned in August 1974. Gerald Ford became president, and he served something like 896 days as president. He was the Republican candidate in 96, but he lost to Jimmy Carter. Back to Betty Ford then. Let's just see here. Yeah, so you've got most of the facts. I mean, she lived the life of a congressman's wife in Washington for many, many years with all that that entails, and I won't go into any details of that. I do want to cover at least two main topics of some of the political activism she was involved with. She was an outspoken advocate for women's rights and was a prominent force in the women's movement in the 1970s. She was an ardent supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment, or ERA. Interesting, the amendment was first introduced to Congress in 1923, coming off of the suffrage movement, and ultimately passed both houses of Congress in 1972, so during this time that Ford was in office. Unfortunately, as many of us recall, the ERA failed to gain ratification by all of the states and expired in 1982. Yet the fact that it was out there and happening had huge impacts on the women's movement. And many state legislatures, of course, were being lobbied to ratify the amendment There were some opponents in certain states that prevented it. Betty Ford was also unapologetically pro-choice. Her active political role in this area prompted Time magazine to call her the country's fighting first lady and name her Woman of the Year. Now, the pro-choice thing, of course, stems from the famous Supreme Court case of Roe v. Wade, which was decided in favor of the plaintiff in 1973 and assured constitutional personal freedom to women to continue a pregnancy or not based on their personal choice. And this is still in force today. Betty Ford, of course, again, was a strong advocate of pro-choice. And though her husband, Gerald, the president at the time, apparently was not, nor was his party, and I believe they remain that way to this day. However, Gerald Ford perhaps conceded differently after his term in presidency. Betty Ford did suffer from breast cancer. Weeks after her husband became president, she became first lady. She underwent a mastectomy for breast cancer. This was September 28, 1974, resulting in her being diagnosed with the disease. She decided immediately to be open about this. Quote, there had been so much cover-up during Watergate that we wanted to be sure there would be no cover-ups in the Ford administration. Her openness about the about her illness raised the visibility of a disease that Americans had previously been reluctant to talk about. Quote, when other women have this same operation, it doesn't make any headlines, she told Time magazine. But the fact that I was the wife of the president put it in headlines and brought before the public this particular experience I was going through. It made a lot of women realize that it could happen to them. I'm sure I've saved at least one person, maybe more, end quote. There was not much time to debate what to say or what much was needed. There had been so much covering up, I'm sorry. The key point from this is that the discomfort that she surely must have experienced by going public and talking about this paid off in that millions of women began performing self-exams, going to screenings, going to the doctor. And this told Betty Ford and the world that she had probably saved countless lives for doing this and started a whole movement in women's health that continues to this day. The explosion of screening meant that the reported incidence of the disease rose, and some researchers in the field call this the Betty Ford blip. The other personal area that led to what I believe is some serious social recognition came also from a personal struggle in Betty Ford's life, and that has to do with addiction recovery. It was the second test of an even greater challenge in her life, since it involved a battle she had waged all through her public life. Her mother, Hortense, used to say that her youngest child popped out of a champagne bottle. Betty said she always liked that idea, though the day came when she almost drowned in one. By the mid-1960s, Betty Ford was struggling with her roles as a political wife, single mother, and civic leader. In 1964, when at the age of 46, she suffered a pinched nerve, likely while trying to open a window. She was put into traction and did physical therapy, but the pain combined with arthritis left her dependent on prescription, drugs, and even and evening cocktails. Within a year, she had fantasies about running away from home just to make her family worry. That's when she began seeing a psychiatrist. And she also talked openly about psychiatric treatment, and I think popularized that during her lifetime. Her tenure as first lady in the presidency then, in a way, was therapeutic. The drinking and the drug use backed off a little bit. It gave her a direction and a focus, many things to do, so that maybe it wasn't surprising that, like many presidential spouses, she felt a sense of anticlimax after she and Gerald left office and settled into an early retirement in a nice house in Rancho Mirage. So after you've been the wife of the president, you settle down in California, some of these old practices come up. So in April 1978, her daughter Susan arranged with other family members and friends an intervention when the whole family and some Navy doctors present, they confronted Betty Ford with the problem of her addiction and what was going on with the family and with friends around her. She was very resistant at first. At that time, there really were no suitable rehab clinics for people like her to go to for those purposes. She entered the Long Beach Naval Hospital in California for treatment. There was no hiding the crisis either. She didn't want people to think that her cancer had returned since she had gone to the hospital. She said, "It's an insidious thing, and I mean to rid myself of its damaging effects." She said of her multiple addictions, "There have been too many other things that I've overcome to be forever burdened with this." 4 years later, after recovery was well underway, with the help of the wealthy tire magnate Leonard Firestone, she cut the ribbon on her 60-foot bed facility in Rancho Mirage that bears her name, the Betty Ford Clinic. Of course, she cut the ribbon right after she had run to Kmart for some soap and shower curtains. So the name Betty Ford, from that time onward, became synonymous with intensive rehab treatment for a disease that can hit anyone. A disease, truly, she explained, not as many would assume the practicing of loose morals or the lack of willpower. She, in fact, was worried about naming the facility the Betty Ford Clinic at that time, not because of the notion of the stigma being forever attached to her name, but because of the fear that she might slip and fail to live up to the example she wanted to set. Quote, "I liked alcohol. It made me feel warm," she wrote in her 87 memoirs. "And I love the pills. They took away my tension and my pain. So the thing I have to know is that I haven't got this problem licked. To my dying day, I will be recovering." Ford and her recovery center put a face on addiction in the United States and in the world. Due to her own case and that of many celebrities, particularly celebrities that would go to the facility, such as actress Elizabeth Taylor, I think perhaps had two visits there, rock star Stevie Nicks, and that famous chicken head biter Ozzy Osbourne, among a few, attended there, but of course brought attention to the issue and to the ability to have such centers. She was not a figurehead. She ran the center, served on the board, greeted supporters at the center by saying, "Hi, my name is Betty. I'm an alcoholic." The Ford Rehab Center, like most others throughout the world, utilizes the long-proven 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which has been active and worldwide since the late 1930s. Some AAs are heard to say among themselves that AA is one of the most popular organizations in the world that no one wants to join. It's true. You or anybody can be addicted, but you don't need to drink or use drugs if you don't want to. When Michael Oldfather first asked me to speak about the life of some person picked off the New York Times obit list, I narrowed my selection down to either Jack Kevorkian, who we're going to hear about next, or Betty Ford. I discussed the features of each one's life with my girlfriend, Stacey Brofman, and after some thought, she pointed out quite nicely that Jack Kevorkian helped people die with dignity. Betty Ford helped people live with dignity. Ford and her legacy helped so many realize that they can overcome addiction to drugs and alcohol and live a good, healthy, constructive life, and we are better off for her life.
Just as a last minute preface, I am reminded that a few years ago in the writers group here at the fellowship, which at that time was being run by Barbara Bascom, at that time Jim Bascom and I engaged in dueling obituaries because one of the exercises that Barbara made us do was to write our own obituaries. And next week maybe I will use that as possibly some of the basis of my remarks. But it is appropriate at this time of noting the passing of individuals during this last year that we provide the counterpoint, as Tom says, by reporting the passing of Jack Kevorkian, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who died June 3rd in Royal Oak, Michigan at the age of 83. He was a medical pathologist who willfully helped dozens of terminally ill people end their lives, becoming a central figure in a national drama surrounding assisted suicide. In arguing for the right of the terminally ill to choose how they die, Kevorkian challenged social taboos about disease and dying while defying prosecutors and the courts. He spent 8 years in prison after being convicted of second-degree murder in the death of the last of 130 patients whose lives he helped end beginning in 1990. His critics were as impassioned as his supporters, but all generally agreed that his stubborn and often intemperate advocacy of assisted suicide helped spur the growth of hospice care in the United States, which we take for granted as a very important part of our culture today, and made many doctors more sympathetic to those in severe pain and more willing to prescribe medication to relieve it. In Oregon, where a school teacher had become Dr. Kevorkian's first assisted suicide patient, state lawmakers in 1997 approved a statute making it legal for doctors to prescribe lethal medication to help terminally ill patients and their lives. In 2006, the United States Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling that found Oregon's Death with Dignity Act protected assisted suicide as a legitimate medical practice. During the time that Oregon was considering this law, Dr. Kevorkian's confrontational strategy gained wide publicity, which he actively sought. National magazines put his picture on their covers, and he grew attention to his cause on television programs like 60 Minutes. His nickname became Dr. Death, and his self-made suicide machine, which he called from time to time the Mercitron or the Thanatron, became fodder for comedians. Even today, Kevorkian is a punchline among many references to the subject of death. Given his obdurate public persona and his delight in flaying critics as hypocritical oafs, Dr. Kevorkian invited and reveled in the public's attention regardless of its sting. The American Medical Association in 1995 called him a reckless instrument of death who proposes a great threat to the public. Counterpoint to that, a prominent Michigan journalist who covered Dr. Kevorkian's one-man campaign wrote in the Detroit Metro Times, quote, "Jack Kevorkian, faults and all, was a major force for good in this society. He forced us to pay attention to one of the biggest elephants in society's living room, the fact that vast numbers of people who are alive would rather be dead who have lives not worth living." In the late 1980s, after an undistinguished career in medicine and an unsuccessful try at a career in the arts, which I will mention later, Dr. Kevorkian rediscovered a fascination with death that he had developed during his early years in medicine. Only now his interest in it was not as a private event, but as a matter of public policy. In the 1960s and 70s, Dr. Kevorkian had shelved his quixotic campaign to engage death for social purposes, and he pursued a largely itinerant career as a medical pathologist. Though his friends described him as funny, witty, personable, and engaging in private, those he met at work and in social situations portrayed him as awkward, grim, driven, quick to anger, and unpredictable. Fiercely principled and equally inflexible, he rarely dated, hard to find a date, and he never married. He lived a penurious life, eating little, avoiding luxury, and dressing in threadbare clothing that he often bought at the Salvation Army. In 1976, bored with medicine, he moved to Long Beach, California, where he spent 12 years painting and writing. In 1984, however, prompted by the growing number of executions in the United States, Dr. Kevorkian revisited an idea that he had when he was in medical school of giving death row inmates a choice He was thus invited to brief the California legislature on a bill that would allow prisoners to donate their organs and die by anesthesia instead of poison gas or the electric chair. About a year later, he returned to Michigan and began advertising in the Detroit area newspapers for a new medical practice that he called bioethics and abiatry, which would offer patients and their families death counseling. He made reporters aware of his intentions, explaining that he did not charge for his services and bore all of the expense of euthanasia himself. He showed journalists the simple metal frame with which he suspended vials of drugs, thiopentol, a sedative, and potassium chloride, and allowed patients to end their own lives. His first patient was in 1990, an Oregon teacher who suffered from Alzheimer's disease. Her life ended on a bed inside Dr. Kevorkian's rusting 1968 Volkswagen van, which was parked in a campground near his home. By his account, he assisted in some 130 suicides over the next 8 years. Patients from across the country traveled to the Detroit region to seek his help. Sometimes the procedure was done in homes, cars, and campgrounds. There were numerous legal actions. In 1991, a state judge issued a permanent injunction barring Dr. Kevorkian from using his suicide machine. The same year, Michigan suspended his license to practice medicine. In 1993, Michigan approved a statute outlawing assisted suicide. The statute was declared unlawful by a state judge, but the Michigan Supreme Court ruled that assisting a suicide and there was no protected right to a suicide assistance under the state constitutions. Nothing mattered to Dr. Kevorkian's, no legal restrictions. Several times he assisted in patient suicide hours after being released from custody for helping in a previous one. He liked attention. At his third trial in 1996, he showed up in court wearing colonial area clothing to show how antiquated he thought the charges were. There were four trials in which he was acquitted in all, but in 1999, the process changed. He had sent a videotape to 60 Minutes, which many of us recall. The tape showed Dr. Kevorkian going well upon assisting a patient in causing his own death by performing the injection himself. The program portrayed him as a zealot with an agenda. It prompted a national debate about medical ethics, and the tape was shown at his trial in Oakland County, Michigan, at which he was finally convicted. The judge said, "You had the audacity to go on national television, show the world what you did, and dare the legal system to stop you." She said further, "Well, sir, consider yourself stopped." However, following 8 years in prison, on June 1st, 2007, Dr. Kevorkian was released after he promised not to conduct another assisted suicide. He had been born Murad Kevorkian in Pontiac, Michigan in 1928. Of immigrant parents, Levon and Satindig Kevorkian, who were Armenian refugees. The young Jack was described by his friends as an able student interested in art and music. He graduated from the University of Michigan after switching to medicine from engineering and was the author of many books on the subject of assisted suicide. As he lay in the hospital, weakened, he could not take advantage of the option he had offered to others and had wished for himself. "This is something I would want." Dr. Kevorkian was a lover of classical music, and before he died, his friend said nurses played recordings of Bach for him in his room.
that was a little sober, so we'll change the subject now and talk about a woman by the name of Lynn Margolis. Lynn Margolis characterized herself as a microbiologist and an evolutionist. And her biggest contribution to the world that we live in, and the world of science in general, was to promote and popularize a theory called endosymbiotic evolution of eukaryotic cells. Got that? So I'll define a couple of terms before we start. Eukaryotic cells are cells that are part of the bodies of almost all higher organisms, and even a few single-celled organisms, and their distinguishing characteristic is that they have their DNA, genetic material, sequestered in the cell in an organelle called the nucleus. If you've got your DNA separated by a nucleus, you are a eukaryotic cell. This is contrasted with something that used to be called a prokaryotic cell, now called cyanobacteria. And in prokaryotic cells, the DNA is not sequestered in a separate nucleus. It's arranged in the cytoplasm. So these are the two important types of cells that you need to know about to understand the significance of her work. So first I'll tell you a little bit about how she grew up and the influences that she came under, and then I'll describe her theory and some of its implications, and then tell you a little bit about how, in my humble opinion, I am not recognized by anybody and I'm not a member of the National Academy of Science, she nevertheless went astray a bit. So Linda Margolis was born Linda Petra Alexander in Hyde Park, which is South Chicago. One obituous characterized this as a tough neighborhood. She was born in 1938, and Hyde Park was not so tough then. In fact, it was a fairly upscale region of South Chicago, and she grew up there, the oldest of four daughters. Her father was a lawyer and a successful businessman. He had owned and developed a company that marketed a thermoplastic material that was used to mark highways. Very successful. And he was also a quasi-state politician. He was the state's assistant attorney general. And her mother owned and ran a travel agency, so it was a fairly privileged life. Lynn was quite precocious, and after her sophomore year at Hyde Park High School, she went directly into the University of Chicago and matriculated there for 4 years. Something most 14-year-olds don't do. While she was there, she became particularly interested in science because in science she could read original manuscripts, the original works of the people who made the contributions, and this was very exciting to her. While there, she also met Carl Sagan, known to many of you as a, let me see if I can say this word right, cosmologist, how about that, who popularized knowledge of the origins of the universe, particularly on public television, until his death in 1996. Then, at that time, he was a graduate student in physics, and so when she graduated from the University of Chicago at the age of 19, they married and went off to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, another excellent university, where she had the good fortune to get a combined master's degree in zoology and genetics with a man by the name of Hans Riess. Hans Riess had a long and productive career himself, and he was a preeminent structural cellular biologist. He developed microscopes that could look into the structures of cells, and he was extremely generous with his techniques. He also, which was remarkable and helpful for her, was one of the earliest proponents for actually giving graduate training to women. And so she worked there with him for 2 years, and then she and Sagan went on to UC Berkeley, another well-known institution, where she did her PhD research. Now, during this period of time, which was the 1960s, Watson and Crick got the Nobel Prize for figuring out the structure of DNA in organisms and how it could be a self-replicating molecule which could carry genetic information from one cell to another, from one organism to its progeny. And I was a little behind Lynn in age, and believe me, everybody and their brother was sequencing DNA from everything. It was a very popular subject. And so for her PhD thesis, what she did actually was to identify the presence of DNA in the cytoplasm of eukaryotic cells, not the nucleus. Beginning in her time in Chicago, she had become interested in evolution and genetics, and particularly starting from long, long ago, billions of years ago, as opposed to hundreds of thousands of years ago. And during her time with Hans Riesch, she'd become interested in, which he was also interested in, diseases or situations in which the inheritance of a characteristic did not follow, I'm going to use another term you won't like, Mendelian distributions. That is, it didn't follow the segregation of the nuclear DNA. It was definitely inherited, but it was inherited through some other organelles or properties besides just the way the nucleus went. So armed with these things, she left the University of Berkeley, left Carl Sagan, and went to Boston, where she spent a few months lecturing at Brandeis, another excellent institution, and then became a professor of botany at Boston University, where she stayed from 1966 until 1988. During that period of time, she met, married, and had two children with a man by the name of Tom Margulis. He was a crystallographer, so another physical scientist having a big impact in her life. In 1980, she and Margulis were divorced, and in 1988, she moved then to the University of Massachusetts, where she spent the rest of her life teaching and doing research. So it was in 1966 that she published her first big revolutionary paper. And this paper grew out of, as I said, her interest in the origins of life, Carl Sagan, and her observations that there were things that were inherited that did not follow typical nuclear genetic patterns of inheritance. And her PhD, in which she actually found the presence of the magic DNA in the cytoplasm of cells, not in the nucleus. And so she proposed this endosymbiotic theory of eukaryotic cell development. And she said that actually evolution, as it was being talked about at that time, was really being talked only about in terms of complex organisms. I mean, Darwin down there on the islands was looking at birds and whole organisms. He wasn't looking at single cells. But if it worked at that level, it had to have started previously. And so she went back to the single cells organisms. And she was curious about how you could get from these prokaryotes to these eukaryotes. And she suggested that, in fact, what happened was that prokaryotes fused to form a symbiotic fusion cell, and that eventually these fusion cells of prokaryotic origin evolved into this more complicated eukaryotic cell. She was happy to tell you ever after that she tried 15 times to get this paper published unsuccessfully until it was finally published in a journal of theoretical biology. And for many years after that, it was roundly rejected by most of the heavyweights in the evolutionary field, evolutionary biology field at that time. until the 1980s, when the technology capabilities of science were sufficient to actually sequence and understand the genes that were present in the cytoplasm and show that these genes that were present in the cytoplasm, which were actually present in two organelles, one common to all high organism cells except red blood cells, and the other to plants, the mitochondria and the chloroplasts, the genes that were contained in these two organelles are not present in the nucleus. And this was considered finally sufficient validation for this idea that perhaps they got there by the fusion of very ancient prokaryotic cells into a more complex cell, which eventually evolved into the eukaryotic cell. And so after 1980s, her theory was actually accepted and is now taught as absolutely accepted thought in evolutionary development of eukaryotic cells. As so often happens to people who have to struggle long and hard to get their ideas accepted, so they sometimes over-embrace them. And I think this is what happened to Lynn Margolis. So while it is true that mitochondria and chloroplasts have DNA in them, and you can see easily how they could have developed from such prokaryotic fusions, she tried to say that the little hairs on cells, known as cilia or flagella to any of you, got there because of fusions with spirochetes. Well, cilia and flagella do not have any DNA associated with their organelle genesis, and this idea has not been accepted as time has gone on, in spite of the fact that the mitochondria and the chloroplasts do seem to be legitimate products of such a fusion. She also, as part of her endosymbiotic cooperative view of how evolution occurred, became quite recalcitrant to the idea that competition between species was ever involved in evolution. And she tried to insist that all evolution was really based on symbiotic cooperation, an idea which has not gained supremacy as time has gone on. She even had an idea for involving symbiosis for how genetic mutation happens in complex species, and that is that DNA changes occur because of the transfer, symbiotic transfer, of nuclear material from the cell of one species using bacteria or viruses into the cells of some other species. And she had no appreciation for actual mutation in the nuclear DNA of the species itself. Another idea which didn't go too far. So she had many good ideas, but also some not too good ones. And her last two, which sort of created the most amount of controversy, in 2009, she still tried to suggest that AIDS was really caused by the same microorganisms that cause syphilis, and that there really was no, because the manifestations of the two diseases were sufficiently similar, and there really was no evidence that the HIV virus was involved in this disease, something, again, which was not accepted. And finally, as a member of the National Academy of Science, she had the privilege of sponsoring papers in the journal PNAS without outside review. So she sponsored a paper by a group of people who tried to suggest that caterpillars evolved from the hybridization of organisms in a group of organisms known as velvet worms. This was roundly, it has a scientific name, but I thought I couldn't pronounce it, so it's a general class of organisms. This concept was roundly rejected, and in fact, in the very Journal of PNAS that published the paper that she communicated, they had a paper by another group who completely rejected this idea. And shortly thereafter, PNAS decided to change its rules for who could communicate a paper to PNAS and under what circumstances. They did. They did. These slight distractions notwithstanding, she was the author of more than 130 articles, 10 books, popularizing for the lay public many cogent principles of evolution. She had served on important committees in AAAS. She was a member of the nominating committee for who would get MacArthur Genius Awards. She was on the editorial board of many journals. She co-directed NASA's Planetary Biology Internship Program. She was elected to the National Academy in 83, received the William Proctor Prize in 1999, and also was given the Medal of Honor of Science by President Clinton. So she was extremely active, and her basic contribution, this endosymbiotic theory of organelle evolution in eukaryotic cells, is still accepted today.
We have a kind of agreement that we will end at noon, and we are there. Let's see, the possibilities are people need to leave to do so, and the rest of us. Okay, is that do I have the group's approval to proceed? Good.
2 minutes. Okay, polemicist who slashed all freely dies at 62. Okay, so that's the heading out of New York Times. Christopher Hitchens, a slashing polemicist in the tradition of Thomas Paine and George Orwell, who trained his sights on targets as various as Henry Kissinger, the British monarchy, and Mother Teresa, wrote a bestseller attacking religious belief and dismayed his former comrades on the left by enthusiastically supporting the American-led war in Iraq, died on Thursday in Houston. He was 62. I knew him mainly as the author of the book God Is Not Great. I used to read his Slate column. I'm interested now in reading some more of his books. Because we're out of time, just a couple short quotes. On what gives life meaning, a life that partakes even a little of friendship, love, irony, humor, parenthood, literature, and music, and the chance to take part in battles for the liberation of others cannot be called meaningless, except if the person living it is also an existentialist and elects to do so. On Jerry Falwell, there's different ways to say people are full of it, okay? If you gave Jerry Falwell an enema, he could be buried in a matchbox. Salman Rushdie wrote the book The Satanic Verses, and there was a fatwa against him. It was, if I can phrase it like this, a matter of everything I hated versus everything I loved. In the hate column, dictatorship, religion, stupidity, demagogy, censorship, bullying, and intimidation. In the love column, literature, irony, humor, the individual, and the defense of free expression. Plus, of course, friendship. Because I was going to read some other stuff, I deleted some that were a little bit strong. Let's see if I can think about. He had one on drink. This is related to gin. He did drink a lot. Something like when drinking gin, you should do it as you would view a woman's breasts. One is far too few, and three is one too many. And then he advised you to eat the olive that could be nutritious for you. And the last one I'll read here. On his manner of living, he was quite a character. I always knew that there was a risk in the bohemian lifestyle, and I decided to take it because, whether it's an illusion or not, I don't think it is, it helped my concentration. It stopped me from being boring and stopped other people being boring to some extent. It would keep me awake. It would make me want the evening to go on longer, to prolong the conversation, to enhance the moment, If I was asked, would I do it again? The answer is probably yes.
Thanks to all of my participants. Much as I love Hildegard of Bingen's hymn, we'll save that for another time. And we'll let David Grimm, who spoke here often, have the closing words. What's the destination? We are all ticket holders on the journey of a lifetime, making our way to one of an infinite number of ports. The amazing thing is that each of us writes our own ticket. With every investment of our time and energy, we are moving ourselves closer to our destination. Look at your diary as well as your checkbook, and you'll find out the destination you're writing on your own ticket. So be it. Thanks to the participants. Thanks to you for coming out. We know who spends a sober New Year's Eve, don't we?